We're going to start today in Revelation 6. We're going to look at verses 12 through 17. Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17. This passage references the sixth seal, which serves as, one might say, a rather auspicious start, or really comes before, just before, the day, start of, or just before, the day of the Lord. A warning to the inhabitants of the earth about the events that are about to unfold. So Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17. And I beheld, and when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casts her untimely leaves when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come. Who shall be able to stand? So a day, a darkened sky, a reddish moon, a great earthquake, falling stars. Great are the signs that precede Christ's intervention in the affairs of this world at the end of this age. So great that people will seek to hide in whatever crannies of the earth that the earth can provide. Now, some have posited that the events that unfold here refer possibly to a great volcano or a meteor shower, and I'm not going to dispute that as a possibility. In fact, we can go back nearly 150 years, and we can read of events that happened at the edge of the Indian and Pacific Oceans, of an island or a volcano called Krakatoa. In the year 1883, the eruption there, at that time, could be heard 3,000 miles away in Africa, in Australia. And ash, for the next year, ash covered the earth, and it led to a worldwide drop in temperature of several degrees for the next year, and also glorious sunsets and famine. Similar conditions and vague references to thundering mountains suggest that Krakatoa may have actually erupted also in the years 416, 535, and 1680. And indeed, a darkened sky, a reddish moon, a great earthquake, well, these would all be manifestations of a great volcanic eruption. And God does sometimes use natural events to get our attention and to get the attention of the inhabitants of the land or of the planet. But at other times, he has used signs that were very definitely supernatural and not easily explained away as the work of a naturally occurring process. And in that regard, what is interesting here in Revelation is that the people seem to grasp that whatever events that occur here toward the end of the age are not simply natural phenomena. Fall on us, they say in verse 16, and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. So it could well be that these particular signs are much more and could be explained away as a volcanic eruption. And of course, the lines could also be interpreted symbolically. And we know mountains are kingdoms, and events could well relate to the fall of a man-made systems and governments that dominate this world and organize the planet that we know. Obviously, with such devastation, it would be natural that nation-states, as we know them, would be compromised under such strain. But my focus today is on the actual physical signs of God's intervention in human affairs. And the opening of the sixth seal in Revelation 6 is not the only place such events are said to take place at the end of the age, just before the second coming of Jesus. So we'll look at a few other passages to get a sense of the degree to which God places importance on the signs that are to come in the heavens and with earthquakes on the earth in the lead up to those final days. So for that, let's turn to next to Matthew 24 and verse 29. Matthew 24 and verse 29. This scripture gives us the timing of the events. It falls within the chapter that the church has traditionally paired up with Revelation in terms of interpreting what the latter book is saying. with its seemingly symbolic language. Matthew 24, verse 29, Jesus is recounted as saying, quote, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. So we are told here that the events occur immediately after the Great Tribulation, which is a time of great trouble on the earth, and particularly for the nations descended from Israel. And again, we have similar signs. We have a dark sky. We have falling stars. A very similar language to that used in Mark 13, verses 24 and 25, and in Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. And that's actually where we'll go next, is to Luke. Luke 21, verses 25 and 26, because this adds a few more details that are not provided in Matthew or in Revelation. Luke 21, verses 25 and 26, talks about some of these signs, and says here, and there shall be signs in the sun, and in the moon, and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts falling for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. So here we can notice a couple of other details. One is that the seas and the waves roar, perhaps an indication of tidal waves, which would be natural fallout, again, from a volcano or some other seismic activity. But another is the fact that the people will be distressed and perplexed. Someone won't know or understand what is going on. And not everybody, I suppose, will conclude that God's punishment is imminent. But everyone will be in fear. So what other desire might one have in such a time than to hide from all that is happening on the planet? Let's look at one other New Testament passage. Let's go to 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, which talks about the ferocity of the events that are to occur. 2 Peter 3 and verse 10. Here Peter writes of the day of the Lord more generally, but its effect on the earth is no less noteworthy. Here he says in 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So Peter notes that the events will come as a shock, as something unexpected, just like a thief in the night. Here he also notes that the heavens will pass away. We won't be able to see them, and with noise, and that there will be great fire and heat, again, like a volcano. Let's look at some Old Testament passages. Let's go to Isaiah 13, Isaiah 13, verses 9 and 10. In fact, this is just only one of a handful of references to the signs that accompany the coming day of the Lord in Isaiah. We're going to look at just two of them. Isaiah 2, verses 10 and 12, both parallel descriptions that as they appear in the New Testament. Isaiah 13, verses 9 and 10. That's the first one that we're going to. Isaiah 13, verses 9 and 10. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light, and the sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. So once again, we have a witness of a darkness that falls over the earth before or at the coming day of the Lord. Now we'll turn back to Isaiah 2. This is the other passage we were going to look at. Isaiah 2, verses 10 and 12. Here we have a reference to the reaction among humankind, one that mirrors the reaction that appears in Revelation. Isaiah 2, verses 10 and 12. Enter into the rock, he writes here, and hide you in the dust for the fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day, for the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. So Isaiah instructs the inhabitants of the earth to hide because of fear. And now we'll drop down to verse 19 of chapter 2, verse 19 of chapter 12, and we'll see what they do. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake terribly the earth. All right, one final passage we'll look at in this regard is in Joel. We'll go to Joel 2, verses 30 and 31. Indeed, the entire book of Joel is dedicated to the day of the Lord, and several other passages refer to similar phenomena. But we could also turn to the Psalms for some similar language, actually, but the passage here in Joel 2, verses 30 and 31 does a good job of summing up the signs that God will provide to the inhabitants of the planet at the end of the age. Joel 2, verses 30 and 31, "And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. And the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come." All right, so there you have it, signs in the heavens, our sixth seal. Now, I said earlier that God often presents signs regarding what he is going to do or warnings before he does them, and that these signs cannot always be explained in terms that would fit with the physical world. And in that regard, I want to look today at three earlier events in human history in which God used such signs in the heavens to forecast the significance of the event and his plans for humankind. And in that sense, I hope that we'll be able to glean a greater appreciation for and understanding of the events that are yet to unfurl at the end of this age. We'll see how God actively involves himself with humankind, with history, and specifically with us. We'll start with one that occurred in Joshua. Joshua 10, verses 12 and 14. Joshua 10, verses 12 and 14. This is an event we're all familiar with. It happened at a time when five kings of the Amorites came up against the people of Gibeon, with whom Israel had made a treaty. And the Israelites went out to defend them. And despite God's assistance, and the great hail that God had sent against the enemy, the battle was a protracted one in which Joshua did this. Joshua 10, verses 12 through 14. "And then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, 'Sun, stand still upon Gibeon, and you moon in the valley of Ajalon.' And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. And there was no day like that before or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." So we refer to this event as Joshua's long day, though of course the one who made it a long day was God. The long day, this sign in heaven wherein the sun shined for an extra 12 to 24 hours, helped further establish the fact that God was fighting for Israel, was with Israel, and it is not something that we can explain naturally. The sun doesn't just stay still. Now, some scholars have tried to argue that the wording here is metaphorical. It just seemed like a long day, and that's possible. But what's interesting is that we have various other accounts of a long day or a long night occurring around the same time in other parts of the world. From Egypt, we have a hieroglyphic account of a flood that was apparently caused by an unusually high tide. The reason for that high tide, the account notes, was as follows. Quote, "The sun, thrown into confusion, had remained low on the horizon, and by not rising it spread terror among the great doctors. 2 days had been rolled into one. The morning was lengthened to 1.5 times the normal period of effective daylight." There are also several accounts of an exceptionally long night in Native American records, that is, here on the other side of the world. Tales of such can be found among the Ojibways, the Wyandots, the Dogrib, and the Bungi. And in the Popol Vuh, that's a sacred book of Central American Kish Mayans, we find this account of a long night. Quote, "They did not sleep. They remained standing, and great was the anxiety of their hearts and their stomachs for the coming of the dawn and the day. Oh, if we only could see the rising of the sun, "What shall we do now?" They talked, but they could not calm their hearts, which were anxious for the coming of the dawn. So according to Montesinos, the collector of the tale, the sun was hidden for nearly 20 hours in the third year of the reign of Titu Yupanqui Pachacuti II. I don't speak Indian, so or Mayan, which would have been about the year 1400 BC. So we see that God intervened in human affairs, and it was written in the heavens across the globe. Okay, a second time that God intervened in the heavens occurred at the time of Jesus' death. Indeed, we might say that in the prophecies examined earlier with regard to Jesus' second coming, we see a precursor in the events that happened at the time of his death. So let's read about that in Matthew 27. Matthew 27, and we'll look at verse 45. Remember that we have what we have at the time that Jesus returns, and we see something here similar toward the time of his death. Matthew 27 and verse 45. "Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over the land until the ninth hour." Okay, from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, 3 hours. "Now some have equated this darkness as being a heavy cloud cover in the local vicinity. And again, that's possible. However, there are a few records of a much more intense darkness. A supposed eclipse that occurred around 33 AD. One that affected the whole world and started around the sixth hour, or noon, as we would call it. One account is that of the Greek historian Thales, who wrote around the year 52 AD, a history of the Eastern Mediterranean. Another is an account in the writings of the Greek historian Phlegon, around 137 AD, which denotes how one could see the stars, not something that is possible when you have heavy cloud cover. Both accounts are preserved for us in the 3rd century history of the world by Africanus, a Christian convert who argues that, of course, a 3-hour eclipse is not possible. So that would therefore not be an eclipse. And it would also not be an eclipse, would not also be possible because we've got a full moon at the Passover time. So a natural explanation for the phenomenon, in other words, is impossible. Phlegon's account is particularly interesting because it also includes a record of a great earthquake that occurred in the region at the same time as the darkness. What do we see in Scripture? Well, let's go down to verses 50 to 54. Matthew 27, verses 50 to 54. "And Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in two, from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake. And the rocks rent, and the graves were open, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose, and came out of the graves after his resurrection, and went into the holy city, and appeared unto many. Now when the centurion, and they that were with him watching Jesus, saw the earthquake, and those that were done, they feared greatly, saying, Truly, this was the Son of God." So we see here three incredible events. The first is an earthquake, which is the explanation for the other two events, namely the veil of the temple being torn in half and the resurrection of various believers. I haven't been able to find any contemporaneous account outside of the Scriptures that talk about resurrections of various people at this time, though, of course, if Matthew was written during the lifetimes of many of the witnesses to these events, then, you know, that surely is enough. You've got, you know, people would have been able to dispute what he was saying here if it wasn't true. However, there are quite a few interesting parallels in other sources with regard to the temple's veil being ripped and to the earthquake. Let's start with the earthquake. Beyond Phlegon's account, we have a recent study by the geologists Williams, Schwab, and Brower. And that study concluded from the deformed sedimentary record in a place called En Gedi, just west of the Dead Sea, that there must have been an earthquake in the region around 31 AD minus plus 5 years, so somewhere in that decade. With regard to the tearing of the temple veil and the earthquake, we have a number of implied coincidences that occur in the Jewish records. And bear in mind that the Jewish powers that be weren't exactly looking to corroborate Jesus' story. and Jesus' importance. Thus, we don't find a direct account in such sources. What we do find, however, is the following. Josephus notes that earthquakes often damaged the temple's upper colonnades, and this was because the temple itself was so heavy that the ground underneath it was constantly settling, making the structure's upper sections somewhat unstable. And Herod apparently attempted to reconfigure the temple and, in fact, issued an edict to commence this work around 41 AD due to the damage that had been sustained in an earthquake some years earlier. One of the items that likely was damaged in the quake was the stone lintel that held the curtain that covered the east entrance to the holy place. Indeed, damage to the lintel is recorded in the apocryphal book, The Gospel of the Nazarenes. All right, so there we have the lintel breaking, the curtain being torn. So there are a couple of other interesting coincidences to note. The Talmud relates that 40 years before the temple's destruction in 70 AD, that is around the time of Jesus' death, around 30 AD or so, the eastern gates began to open of themselves. Perhaps this, too, was the result of earthquake damage. No matter the fact that the gates couldn't be appropriately kept shut anymore, for anyone in the vicinity would have been able to see that curtain had been ripped because they could look right in through those open doors. And finally, we also find that 40 years before the temple's destruction, that is around the time of Jesus' death, the Sanhedrin changed its place of meeting. Previously, it had met in an inner court of the temple called the Chamber of Hewn Stones. However, right around the time that the earthquake would have damaged the temple, we find the Sanhedrin choosing to meet instead at a nearby trading station. Could the temple damage have been the reason that the chamber was no longer used? Could Jesus' death penalty, in fact, have been the very last decision rendered in the Chamber of Hewn Stones? Something to think about. Of course, it is hard to imagine a mere earthquake and the breaking of the curtain holder as the reason that a heavy veil would be torn in two from top to bottom. More was likely at play here than naturalistic causes. We often think of that tearing as emblematic of the fact that with Jesus' death, access to the Holy of Holies was given to all mankind through Jesus' atoning for our sins. And that is indeed very significant. But another way to think of that tearing the veil is, as the scholar Ralph P. Martin puts it, as God's intervention in human affairs. God reaching into our realm, the human realm, and touching every one of us through a physical act that demonstrates his presence. So we've looked at extra-biblical accounts of God's hand in human affairs, of signs in the heavens, two of them. We might note on the ground in these two cases, Joshua's long day and the death of Jesus. Let's look at one more before we close. Let's go again to Matthew 24. Matthew 24. Remember when the disciples came to Jesus and asked him about the signs at the end of the age, they equated it with another event. Equation is displayed for us in Matthew 24, verses 1 through 3. Let's look at that. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See you not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another, and that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming, and the end of the world? So Jesus was talking initially about the destruction of the temple, the physical temple. For the disciples, that seemed like something so incredible that it could only mean the end of the world, the coming of the Messiah in all his glory. So they equated these two things together. Jesus provides a set of signs, some of which we've already looked at, that were to presage the marvelous events at the end of the age, but also that were to presage the temple's destruction. Today, that temple is gone. We still wait for many of the events that Jesus recounts here in Matthew 24 and that John reaffirmed in the book of Revelation. And yet, many of the events recounted here also did happen at the time of the temple's destruction. So this was a warning to the disciples and a prophecy with dual implications. What did Jesus warn his disciples? Let's look at verses 4 through 6. Same chapter, Matthew 24. And Jesus answered and said unto them, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So what happened in the years leading up to the temple's destruction? Some among the Jewish people rose up claiming, "I am the Messiah. I will deliver Israel. I will deliver Judah from the Romans." And indeed, such claimants were not uncommon among the Jews in the Roman world. In fact, we won't turn there, but Acts 5, verses 36 and 37 tells us what? We get a reference to a few of those claimants. And here we have Gamaliel talking to the Jewish council about Peter and John and this newfangled sect of followers of Jesus. And he notes the inefficacy of earlier messianic movements there in Acts 5, verses 36 through 37. He says, "For before these days rose up Thaddeus, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves who was slain, and as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to nothing. And after this man rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, and drew away much people, and he also perished, and all, even as many obeyed him, were dispersed." Paul, too, in Acts 21 and verse 38, again, we won't turn there, is mistaken for a messianic claimant. Acts 21, 38, an Egyptian who led people against the Roman powers. So such ideas were in the air, and they led eventually to the rebellion of the Jews against the Romans and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So let's now drop to verses 9 and 10 of Matthew 24. Verse 9 and 10. "Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another." So we obviously see this in the way that the disciples were treated among the priests and the Pharisees and in many of the synagogues of their day. But there is also a fulfillment in the manner in which some of those who stuck to an understanding that Jesus was the Messiah were treated in the lead-up to the rebellions against the Romans. If you didn't subscribe to the notion that God was leading Israel to freedom, and you didn't take up arms with your neighbors, you were a traitor. Now let's drop down to verse 16 of Matthew 24. Here we have Jesus offer the church a warning, a very direct warning. "Then let them, which be in Judea, flee into the mountains." All right. So now the impetus for this warning is given in the previous verse, the abomination of desolation. But if we go to the parallel account in Luke, which we can do now, let's go to Luke 21. Luke 21, we'll look at verses 20 and 21. Jesus gives a slightly different warning with regard to when to flee. Luke 21, verses 20 and 21. "And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is near. And then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto." So the five-year war between Judah and the Roman Empire that would eventually lead to the destruction of the temple began in 66 AD at Masada, when a group of Jews killed Roman soldiers posted there. And the year, as believers gathered in Jerusalem for that year, as believers gathered in Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles, the Roman general Cestius Gallus surrounded the city with his army, taking into possession Bethsaida, a suburb of Jerusalem. But for some odd and unknown reason, Cestius withdrew his troops after he surrounded the city. The Jews pursued the Roman troops, capturing an assortment of equipment that would help them further defend the city and bolstering their courage and their belief that God was with them. Gallus even sent ambassadors to the Jewish leaders asking for peace and proffering forgiveness. But the Jews decided that instead of taking them up on their offer, they decided to kill the ambassador. And that brought down the hard hand of the empire and the temple's eventual destruction. When Cestius Gallus surrounded Jerusalem, it appeared that the Christians within the city were doomed. And in fact, when the city and nation did fall, Josephus tells us that around 1 million Jews died. And another 100,000 were taken captive. But Gallus' sudden withdrawal enabled the Christians to do something that may have seemed counterintuitive to those around them. For a three-day interval, the gates of the city were opened. And rather than walling up in the city for safety, or pursuing after the Romans as the Jewish warriors did, the Christians fled north across the wilderness. But our focus in this passage has been on the signs in the heavens. Earlier we noted how Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 24:29 that just before his coming, the sun would be darkened, and the moon would not give her light, and the stars would fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens would be shaken. Were there also signs in the heavens before the temple's destruction? Indeed, from historical accounts, it appears that there were. Josephus tells us that in the year 66 AD, during the second Passover season, a heavenly army appeared in the clouds surrounding Jerusalem. Moreover, a comet described as being in the shape of a sword was visible over the city for a full year. The Talmud also testifies of various odd events that occurred during the 40 years between Jesus' death and the temple's destruction, which I won't get into here. But the point is that God's hand, his warnings, manifested in the physical world before the momentous events were to occur that forge part of his plan, including the destruction of the temple just at the end of time, just as at the end of time, we will see signs in the heavens before the destruction of this world's system of government, economy, and religion. So as the signs were very evidently supernatural in Joshua's day and at Jesus' death and at the destruction of the temple, such that those who would accept them knew their true meaning, so too at the end of the age will those who are of God know that God himself is the source of the signs in the heavens. Understanding this, what should we as believers in God do in the lead up to such events? I have two scriptures in that regard. The first one is a familiar one. It comes from the Lucan account. We're still there in Luke 21, verse 36, where Jesus is having his discussion with the disciples about the destruction of the temple and the end of the world. And Jesus' description of the events, his narrative, what was to come both to the believers in their day and to those at the end of the age, Jesus ends his discussion with this. Verse 36, Luke 21. Watch ye therefore, and pray always, that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things which shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. Remember the reaction of those who were caught unaware. They fear. They hide in the rocks, asking to be covered up, to be hidden from the events that are befalling them and from the return of Jesus, who has come to punish those who have done wrong. All right, now let's turn to Zephaniah 2. And we're going to look at verses 1 through 3. This will be our last scripture here. Here we'll see that there is indeed a place of hiding that God promises to his people in that day. But it's a different kind of hiding place. It is not physical in the way that those who dwell on physical things seek physical salvation by hiding in physical rocks. Zephaniah 2, verses 1 and 2. Gather yourselves together. Yes, gather yours together, O nation not desired, before the decree brings forth, before the day passes the chaff, before the fierce anger of the Lord come upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger come upon you. So here God warns his people, his nation, about the events to come and about how they are not prepared. They are not on watch. They are not praying. They are wrapped up in their own lives rather than taking on the concern for the things of God and for the people around them. What does God tell them to do instead? Verse 3, seek you the Lord, all you meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness, that it may be you shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. So if we seek God first, if we remain loyal to his way, faithful in what we do and say, knowing that it is God alone who gives us favor and who forgives us when we fail to live up to his standards, we might well be hidden from his anger. We might well escape. And when the heavens roll away and the sun and moon don't give their light and the earth beneath our feet quakes, we will, instead of being in fear as the rest of this world will be, we will have, as Paul calls it, in Philippians 4 and verse 7, we're not doing there. You will have Philippians 4 verse 7, the peace of God, which passes all understanding. How can you be calm at a time like this? How can we be at peace, others might ask, when all around us is a shambles? Because we know, we might say, that the signs are from God, and that Jesus is on his way, and God is again about to directly enter human affairs, and we are the ones praying Godspeed that day.